at KFAI.org. I'm Manny Harview. In the first part of the hour, our man Josh talks with Chantel Pratt about her book, Neuroscience is You, How Every Brain is Different, and How to Understand Yours. With style and wit, Chantel takes us on a tour of the meaningful ways that our brains are dissimilar from one another's. Using real-world examples, along with take-em-yourself tests and quizzes, sounds fun, she shows you how to identify the strengths and weaknesses of your own brain while learning what might be going on in the brain of those who are unlike you.
And I'm Dave Fettig. Then, in the last part of the hour, we will feature one of our reprint interviews,
otherwise known as legacy interviews. Tune in as we go do a deep dive into the archives to play an interview from the past. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio, and now this.
Chantel Pratt is a professor at the University of Washington with appointments in the Department of Psychology, Neuroscience, and Linguistics, and at the Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences, the Center for Neurotechnology, and the Institute for Neuroengineering. She also has a badass tiger tattoo. I found that last night. So.
That is the coolest part of the introduction. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
The Neuroscience of You is a rollicking adventure into the human brain that reveals the surprising truth about neuroscience, shifting our focus from what's average to an understanding of how every brain is different. Chantel, welcome to Right On Radio.
Thank you for having me. That's definitely, I like the improvised introduction quite a lot.
So
as he drew
really,
this freehand on my back, and it, you know, I had a vision and it was, you know, sort of like this tigress. And he said, is she curious? Is she protective? And he drew it on my body. And like, until he drew it on my body, I was like, wow, that's really big.
It's huge. It's like your entire, yeah, I know.
I asked my husband, Corey and I talked for 13 hours. I sat there for 13 hours in that shop and we talked about the brain and life and all of the ways that, you know, all the magic that I understand that he was curious about. And, but the whole time we were there, I was like, can we afford this? Am I going to have to call my mom? it was an insane, and wonderful experience, but yeah, that's definitely something different that you don't expect for a neuroscientist to have.
Part of the subtitle of this book is how every brain is different. You describe very early in the book how when you heard Steven Pinker say that all normal people have the same physical organs, we all surely have the same mental organs, your brain's response was, what a bunch of bullshit. Why are minor neurological differences relevant in understanding ourselves?
Well, I think I like to talk about, what does it matter? It's not that, you know, my brain is not identical to its own self when we started this conversation, right? So it's changed in front of you and in front of our discussion, you know, my brain is adapting. So the question becomes like, is this important? Like, what is the implication of a small change? And, you know, the example I give is it really depends on what it is you're trying to understand. And at the end of the day, the chimpanzee and ourselves share 95 or 96% of our DNA. Our brains are incredibly similar, but that 5% of a difference between our brain and a chimpanzee brain allows us to communicate in a shared symbolic language that lets us tell stories and share the inner workings of our minds, where chimpanzees in the wild still spend a great part of their day foraging for food, forming social bonds. They have very complicated intellectual and social lives, right? But that 5% makes a huge difference. And I think when it comes to our own intuitive understanding that we don't all work the same, you know, it's like if you have a sibling or a child or just a close relationship, it can become really obvious that two people in the same place and time can come away with really different interpretations of what happened.
Yeah.
And in those cases, we're just seeing something that's on the smaller scale, you know, 0.001% can have a really big impact on how you perceive the world and act in it.
The field of neuroscience, you talk about how we learned a lot by what we have in common, by focusing on group averages, mm-hmm. but it slowed in our ability to understand the things that make us unique. Mm-hmm. Why did neuroscientists shy away from studying individual differences?
I think that question is complicated and important. And I try to acknowledge that so that it doesn't feel like I'm shaming the 150 years of one size fits all neuroscience that we've done. A few reasons. From a pragmatic perspective, studying individual differences almost necessarily requires either studying a lot of people or studying a small group of people over multiple time points. And that's really expensive and time consuming either way. Then there's the fact of responsibility. And what is it that somebody is going to infer? If I say your brain makes you this way and my brain makes me this way, what is somebody going to do with that information? Are they going to infer that that means you were born that way, that you can't change? Like, how are they going to report that data? So I think people are concerned about talking about differences that they may be misinterpreted or used conveniently to, you know, forward an agenda or something like that. And within that space, you know, I get asked a lot of questions about male and female brains and so forth and so on. I think it's important from a purely scientific, you know, at the intersection of science and responsibility is the fact that most of the things that we're very curious about that we want to understand about individuals are things that we can't experimentally manipulate in the lab. That is, whether I'm interested in how your memory works, or whether I'm interested in sex or gender, or whether I'm interested in bilingual language experiences, for the most part, a person walks in with a lifetime of experiences that may be related to that feature that you're interested in. And you can't separate the way they were built from the kind of experiences that have shaped their brain. You don't have experimental control over those things.
Elon Musk believes that we will be able to fully understand human brains in our lifetimes. Why do you think this is not true?
I am very confident that this is not true. And that I think that, you know, I live here in Seattle. There are a lot of tech companies that are toying around with trying to understand the brain in different ways. And the brain, I believe, is going to be a great humbler of engineers. And that's not to say that the tools of engineering and signal processing aren't really, really, really useful in studying brains, but the brain is biological. And as you're in the process of trying to understand it, it's changing right under your hands or eyes or algorithms, right? And so I think that, to be fair, I think that going to Mars is hard too, and they're making great progress there. But I think, again, like the problems involved in going to Mars aren't changing as fast as you're trying to solve them. Our brains are, here's the deal. At the end of the day, your brain is trying to understand itself. You're stuck in a closed loop circuit, right? And we have tools and we have math and we're growing, but our brains are just very complicated. They're dynamic and they're different. Like, this is the thing. People haven't even started to crack open this variation piece. Most of the big advances we've made are, what are the commonalities? How can we understand the things that are similar? And when you start to take that space and appreciate differences, the problem becomes like an order of magnitude more complicated. And, you know, the very basic things like the nature of consciousness, like, I don't think we've made dramatic progress on that in the last decade. So it's, you know, I feel very cautious, optimistically pessimistic that we're not going to solve it.
I think it's
we can't even predict the behavior of the C. elegans, this roundworm with, like, you know, a very small number of neurons. We can't perfectly understand how they behave yet. So it's like, let's scale it up to humans.
And that's what, something like 30 neurons within the
C. elegans? I think they have 100, and I can't remember. I wrote it in the book. Like, I want to say less than 200, 180 or something. But we have a perfect map of their entire nervous system. We know every, like, neurochemical. We know all of the connections in that behaving creature. And we still can't perfectly predict how they will respond in an individual environment. So we got a ways to go.
Yeah. Something I didn't consider before reading your book is our definition of typicality of brains. It's mostly informed by a very specific audience that we've tested over a long period of time. Why is this a problem, and what are some examples of your efforts in capturing true neurodiversity in people?
That's why is it a problem? Well, we are, first of all, when we don't consider variability, we take a characterization of the group of people we're studying. And then we try and apply it to humanity, right? But the people we're studying are often white, Western educated college undergraduates at a very particular point in their life, at a very particular, in a very particular environment. And we're using this to sort of create the norms around what average brains look like and how average brains function. And I think that that's problematic in and of itself. But when we then also use that group to define functionality, like that group and the ecosystems they exist in, like a university or a classroom or, you know, a typical Western business, you know, we're missing a lot. Like, you know, so if somebody tells me that a behavior is atypical, I want to know in who. And if somebody tells me that a behavior or and a behavior driven by the brain is dysfunctional, I want to know for who and in what culture, in what environment, because our brains, you know, the vertebrate brain has been evolving for hundreds of millions of years, depending on where you pick the fork. And the environments that we're asking them to operate in are, you know, only a slice of, you know, what the environments we're evaluating them in are really specific when you consider all the jobs you might want a brain to do to help a person survive and thrive in the natural world.
A concept I was not familiar with in neuroscience is lopsidedness. Mm. How does it impact the way I understand the world around me?
Great question. I think a lot of people, you know, a lot of people understand that there are differences in our brains, and we might say, I'm not wired that way. Or we might say, the thing I hear a lot is, I'm a left brain thinker, I'm a right brain. And what they mean there is typically there's a very strong instantiation in pop culture that our left brain is analytical and our right brain is creative. And this work is actually born out of some research that was conducted by someone in my academic lineage. One of my graduate advisors worked with Michael Gazzaniga, who was on the team that first studied patients who had had their brains surgically severed in two. Callosotomy patients. They're commonly called split brain patients, but you've taken the corpus callosum away. And here's the deal. I think this is like so wild. Every vertebrate animal essentially has two brains in one. We have two cerebral hemispheres that are largely independent processors. There's a high-speed core in the middle with which they can share information. And so we perceive the world in this whole and integrated way. But in these patients, when they severed those connections, the different halves of their body that are driven by different hemispheres would behave in different ways. But yet the verbal part of their body, which is the left hemisphere, or the verbal part of their brain, which is the left hemisphere for most typically lopsided people, will make up a story. It would observe the way the other side of the body and brain were behaving and would make up a story about why. And so they called this the interpreter. Gazzaniga, Sperry, and colleagues. And from this interpreter side of the brain arose this pop psychology myth of an analytical left hemisphere and a creative right hemisphere. But we still have this, you know, there's a reason that we have two hemispheres. They don't do exactly the same thing. They are taking in inputs largely in parallel, and they're interpreting them in slightly different ways. So the idea of lopsidedness is really that one of the ways that humans on average differ from other vertebrates is that our two hemispheres can be pretty dramatically different in size and structure. And within human beings, some of us are more lopsided than others, meaning that some of us have bigger differences in the kinds of processing that the two hemispheres do and the kinds of jobs that they come to excel at. and by virtue and the kinds of answers they come up with when put into the same environment. And like most of the things that I talk about in my book, there are good and bad things involved in both ways of being, having a more balanced brain or having a more specialized brain, kind of two perspectives in one head, so to speak.
So I want to delve a little further into this. I was aware of left-handedness only making up what, roughly 10% of the population. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that there was a spectrum of dominance for handedness, mm-hmm. where 3-4% of the population is consistently left-hand dominant. Full disclosure right now, I'm extremely left-hand dominant, I found out from your book. So it may be very interesting to hear what you had to say about this. So I was wondering if you could talk about how hand dominance impacts informational processing between detail-oriented.
Yeah. So I'm going to start with the most honest and dissatisfying answer. And that is that we don't know almost anything about your brain. And you know this if people will learn this about my book, because my daughter is also this extreme lefty who, you know, by convenience sake, by the fact that I had a child when I started neuroscience and started, you know, practicing on her brain. So just literally because she grew up arm's length away from a neuroscientist, I have this interesting, rich data set on her brain. And I have tried, you know, and I try in the book to cover all of the research, the very few small number of studies that have studied handedness with the appropriate kind of sophistication. It's not enough. It's not enough to know, because what happens is, this is one of the big consequences to the one size fits all approach to neuroscience. I would say 95 to 98% of all neuroscientific studies exclude left-handers. And not even left-handedness defined in any kind of sensitive way. Like you were saying, it's a continuum, right? So at some point in the continuum, left and right-handers don't look that different from one another. People who are balanced brains, although people who are, you know, anywhere, if their right hand is like close to as skilled as their left, you'll wind up being pushed right-handed because of the world and the way tools are developed. But with really sloppy definitions, and I've been guilty of this myself, we decide that 10% of the population who identify as left-handed are not going to be represented in neuroscience research. And the justification for this you will read in a grant application is left-handers are more variable, which I'm not 100% sure that has been scientifically demonstrated, but some purport, you're certainly more likely to be having reverse laterality if you're strongly left-handed than if you're, you know, balanced or right-handed. So the first and unsatisfying answer is that, you know, we don't have good models of 10% of the population. And think about what that means for like surgery, healthcare, you know, education. It's just, it's unthinkable. Based on the few studies that have done this well and have overrepresented left-handers and have looked at handedness on a continuum, it seems as though the more strongly left-handed you are, the more likely you are, although this is incredibly rare, to have reverse lateralization of your functions. That means that language comes to be greater over the right hemisphere of your brain than the left. And when it comes to this interpretation or storytelling in the brain, this makes me really curious, because remember that Gazzaniga and their team found that in most of their participants, the left hemisphere was the one that had the kind of conscious dialogue about why people were doing what they were doing. And with that comes the left hemisphere in most typically lateralized people's brains, the left hemisphere has this ability of projecting into the future or generating cause and effect kinds of arguments. And so what it makes me wonder is the storytelling of extreme left-handers, is it more likely to come from the right hemisphere? And if so, are their right hemispheres wired exactly like the typical left hemisphere, or are they getting this more integrative whole picture approach in the way they understand the world? There's no zero research on this, but, you know, like I said, one very longitudinal study of my daughter and a lot of, you know, interest and observations.
In your chapter, Go ahead.
I just wanted to throw this out there. Like, part of what you asked about my research and what we're doing to fix it. And I think part of what we've been doing is trying to broaden recruitment of people in our study that aren't just coming from college campuses, that are coming from other places in the city, that are coming from junior colleges, et cetera. And another thing that I'm really excited to launch with my book is that we're now putting different brain games on the internet that people, if they want to volunteer for research, can go on, tell me what kind of, you know, do the handedness questionnaire, you know, if they want, they can give me demographics. It's not like name or identifying information, and then do these studies. And I'm just hoping that we can have models that fit more diverse brains.
Well, because we're pretty close to running out of time here, so I'm going to jump forward here. I'm going to have to ask you maybe the most important question of this interview right now. What really controls our brains?
Our brains control our brains. But I think that, which is a thing, you know, in the book, I'm really careful to not call this the homunculus problem. But there are multiple ways that our brains control our behavior, right? And I think the reason I think our brain controls our brain is because all of the different control systems of the brain are interested in success of the animal, right? Like at the end of the day, your brain has a very specific goal, and that's to move you through life in a way that gets you the most pleasure points without getting you killed. In fact, the more specific goal is to find another brain that's compatible with yours so you can reproduce and create, you know, other brains with your genes. But the interesting thing of the human brain, when we feel like the identity part of us, when we feel like we are in control, what that means is that there's some operating goal, there's some behavioral goal that we're consciously aware of, right? It's like, I think I'm sleepy, so I'm going to go get a cup of coffee, and I'm going to move my body into the kitchen and execute these behaviors that get me a cup of coffee. But that system for controlling our behavior is only one of multiple systems, including a large portion of our behavior that's driven by implicit learning and by implicit goals. And so, you know, the implicit system is pretty straightforward, but not everybody, the implicit system is like learning from the outcomes of your choices. And the brain stores this database, like this worked well in this context, this worked well in this context, the databases and connections between neurons. But even in that, not every brain works the same. Some people, brains are controlled by moving away from bad things more strongly than moving toward good things. And in other people, it works in a different way. So that's one way the brain controls itself or controls the body. And the other way is, you know, when you have this goal that you're consciously aware of, it's living in the frontal lobe of your brain. It's active in the frontal lobe of your brain. But there are these little helper circuits in the middle of the brain that are also related to reward. And those parts of the brain say, hey, if this is the way I want to behave, if this is the way I'm explicitly aware of wanting to be, I'm going to maximize success by turning up relevant information and turning down irrelevant information. And I think that this is something people miss. Like, we want to be in control and we want to be goal directed and we want to be focused, but you might not appreciate that when you're in that state, your brain is altering reality in a way that's helping you to be success, what you've defined as success. And that means it's not just processing what's around you. Hopefully right now, everyone's brain is turning down the sound of the garbage truck that's outside backing up and listening to my voice as just an example, right? But you might have a goal of maintaining a particular belief or something about, you know, like I really like to believe that I'm an optimist. So my brain turns up the signals on all the happy days and, you know, turns down all the signals on the days that I'm, you know, real cranky for whatever reason. And so, you know, that control is quite literally changing the way you perceive what's actually in front of you. It's altering your reality. So, you know, good or bad, it's just different for For sure.
I have a lot more questions, but I think we're out of time here right now. You've been listening to my conversation with Chantel Pratt talk about her new book, The Neuroscience of You. You can check it out to learn how brains engineer differently, ultimately take diverse paths when it comes to prioritizing information, using what they've learned from experience, relating to other people, and so much more. Chantel, thanks so much for being on my show.
When Saladin laid siege to Jerusalem in late September 1187, an English woman wearing a borrowed coat of armour and a cooking pot for a helmet helped defend the city walls. Margaret of Beverley had been born in the Crusader Kingdom while her parents were on pilgrimage to the Holy Land in the mid-12th century, but she grew up in the north of England, helping to raise a much younger brother, Thomas, who eventually became a Cistercian monk. Later, when she was perhaps in her 20s, Margaret returned to Jerusalem on pilgrimage. It was hardly a settled realm, and through bad luck and worse timing, Margaret found herself trapped in the holy city as the Ayyubids swept in. In years to come, she would recall the terror of the siege, during which citizens had to scramble whatever sort of a defense they could in the absence of able-bodied soldiers. "Although a woman," read Margaret's account, "I looked like a warrior. She launched missiles from a slingshot at Saladin's armies beneath the ramparts, and she ran back and forth between the streets and walls, fetching water for her comrades, all the while swallowing down her fear. At one point, a rock the size of a millstone, thrown from one of Saladin's catapults, crashed into the city and narrowly missed her. She was cut by shrapnel as it shattered, leaving her with a wound so deep it scarred. Quick medical attention ensured the injury did not prove life-threatening, but when the city fell, Margaret was taken captive and forced, like the rest of her fellow Christians, to buy her freedom. Fortunately for Margaret, no sooner had she paid her ransom and left Jerusalem than she was captured near Lachish, just over a mile from the Jaffa Gate, and taken prisoner again. This time there was no easy escape. She was set to work chopping wood and gathering stones, and she endured beatings, threats, and the torment of hard labor throughout two bitter winters. If I refused, I was beaten with sticks, she recalled. My chains rusted with my tears. After 15 months of ill treatment, Margaret was sold to a wealthy man from Tyre, one of the few Crusader cities that had managed to resist Saladin. Margaret's buyer in Tyre granted her freedom as a pious act to celebrate the birth of one of his sons, but her sufferings were far from over. She was left penniless, dressed in rags that barely covered her, to wander a land in which Christian authority had collapsed. God had forsaken the Franks, and Margaret was suffering as much as any of them.
Excellent. You just listened to Dan Jones read from his new work, Crusaders, the Epic History of the Wars for the Holy Lands. Dan Jones is a New York Times bestselling author of The Templars, The Plantagenets, The War of the Roses, Magna Carta, and Summer of Blood. He represented Secrets of the Great British Castles, that's also on Netflix. Dan, thanks for being on Right on Radio with us.
No, thanks for having me.
So I want to begin, I want to ask you about the quote that you used at the beginning of the book from Adam of Bremen. It's, in those days, men cared as much for furs as they did for their mortal souls. Why did you choose this quote?
I chose that quote because it felt to me to very pithily sum up two of the most important aspects of crusading and the relationship between them. On the one hand, these wars, which very often, you know, tapped into the basic stuff of warfare, which is acquisitiveness, you know, trying to capture resources or land, or in this case, as Adam of Bremen is talking, and when he's talking about the Baltic Crusades, furs, you know, valuable goods. But it's also about religion, and it's about faith, and it's about the overlaying of faith onto the sort of basic human greed that underpins warfare. And I think Adam of Bremen's little quote there, "They cared as much for furs as their immortal souls," tells us that this is always existing in a kind of balance, and that, you know, the cynical will look upon this and say, "Hey, were these crusades really about faith?" And the believers will say, "Yes, absolutely, they were." And that sort of interesting, you know, question, which recurs throughout 400 years of history, is what tapped me into and the Crusades in the first place.
You open the book with your reasons for calling the book Crusaders. You say the title reflects the approach to storytelling that you took in this book. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your approach in telling the stories in Crusaders.
Yeah, I mean, that title Crusaders, as opposed to the Crusades, is very important because the book proceeds, it's divided into three parts, each of 9 chapters. That's 27 chapters total. And each one takes somebody involved in the Crusades and uses their viewpoint, so like viewpoint chapters. George R. R. Martin used these in Game of Thrones. It takes viewpoint chapters and guides you through a little slice of the history from a very intimate personal perspective. And then we switch in the next chapter to another character, and usually someone whose perspective will differ somewhat. So you see the similar part of time through a different perspective, and I've cast it as widely as possible to reflect just what a huge span of territory and of different types of people the Crusades touched. So by calling it Crusaders and by adopting the viewpoints of individuals who are Crusaders or touched by the Crusades, I feel like what I've done is create a much more kind of human and immediate and an immersive vision of the Crusades than you would normally get in a book that surveys this big sort of 4 centuries of medieval history.
Well, I was kind of a funny incident while reading. With the Crusades, you could arguably say, didn't begin out of a religious fervor, but out of a fart. I was wondering if you could talk about the story of Count Roger of Sicily and his cousin called Baldwin that started the events.
Yeah, you know, normally the way that we hear the Crusades beginning is Urban II stands up in Clermont, gives a sermon, says, come on, let's go and save Constantinople and Jerusalem. You know, you'll have your sins forgiven if you do. Take up arms in the name of Jesus Christ. We've heard that story a million times. I was like, how was this story being told by the people who had the Crusaders coming towards them rather than the people who were doing the crusading? Now, you go and look at Ibn al-Athir, you know, one of the great Islamic chroniclers of the whole Middle Ages, writing in the 13th century in Iraq. He tells a very different story. He says this is all about Sicily. Now, in the 1060s, the Normans had gone down to Sicily. You normally think 1066, the Normans are in England with William the Conqueror. No, they were also in southern Italy. They come down to southern Italy, Robert Guiscard and his brother Roger. They conquer Sicily. Now, Sicily had been in Arab-Muslim hands, which is why Ibn al-Athir is interested in this story. He says once Roger had taken control of Sicily, Robert Guiscard had gone off to fight in the Balkans. Once Roger was, as Count Roger, in control of Sicily, his cousin Baldwin, ill-defined by Ibn al-Athir, but in the Crusades, most people are called Baldwin. Don't worry about it. Cousin Baldwin sends some ambassadors down to Roger and says, how about we use Sicily as a launch pad for Baldwin to go capture some more rich Islamic-held cities in North Africa? And Roger hates the idea. He hates it so much he doesn't even say anything. He just lifts up his leg and farts in the general direction of the ambassadors. Or at least this is the story Ibn al-Athir says. Tells. And he says, no way, I've conquered Sicily, it's mine, I've got an interest in the trade with these Muslims in North Africa, I'm not having you ruin that by conquering them. He says, if you want to go kill Muslims and nick their city, head east, my friend, and go to Jerusalem. There's loads of Muslims over there. And Ibn al-Athir says, that's how the Crusades began. Now, there are many problems with this story. Who's this Baldwin? We don't know. Which African city is it? Ibn al-Athir is not clear. Is he just telling us that Roger farted at some ambassadors as a way to make the Franks, you know, the Normans, the Westerners, the Christians, look coarse and smelly and disgusting? Very possibly he is. But it touches on a really important point about the beginning of the Crusades, which is that it's not just one pope who has a bright idea. It's that all over the Mediterranean, Christian and Muslim powers had been at war for decades. And those wars were starting to take a specifically religious flavor rather than just being they happen to be wars between Christians and Muslims, just as there were wars between Muslims and Muslims and Christians and Christians, that this was now becoming the point of fighting and the Christians were on the march. So that's why Ibn al-Athir tells the story. And that's why I tell the story at the start of Crusaders, because it's a funny story. Of course it's a funny story, but it also flings you into this world from a totally different perspective than the one you normally get.
Mm-hmm. Crusaders is the first to tell the stories of women and people of color and other marginalized groups during the Crusades. I was wondering if you could talk about why it took so long for this to happen.
Well, I think it's the case that there are lots of disparate groups of scholarship about the Crusades. So lots of academics, you know, might specialize in working on women in the Crusades, or on Sunni or Shia Muslims in the Crusades, or on Jewish people in the Crusades, or, you know, what have you. The syntheses, you know, the big books that put the stories together have traditionally been quite bad at knocking these stories together, at helping them sit side by side. And that's why I chose this approach to Crusaders, which was deeply personal. So you can get into the space of these individuals from across the spectrum of people affected by the Crusades and sort of ride with them through their portion of the story. It gives you a much better flavor for their world, their preoccupations, their point of view. And it allows them, if you like, to sort of coexist with the more traditional characters that we often hear about, Richard the Lionheart and, you know, Philip Augustus, King of France, and great St. Louis, you know, going off and fighting in, you know, in Egypt and Jerusalem. So that's what I've tried to do, is put it all together, and that's been the big task that I think has eluded a lot of Crusade historians over the generations.
One person I was not familiar with until I read your book was, I think I'm going to probably pronounce her name wrong here, but Anna Cromna. She's a person, just glad you was discovered in your book. I was wondering if you could talk about who was she and why was she important for the Crusades?
Yeah, Anna Komnene, she's the daughter of the Byzantine Emperor. So the Byzantine Emperor ruled in Constantinople over what had been the eastern half of the great Roman Empire. Took in modern Greece and Turkey and the islands of the eastern Mediterranean, stretched as far east at some points as modern Syria. So the emperor at the time of the First Crusade, so in the 1090s through 1118, was called Alexius Komnenos. He had a daughter, a very brilliant daughter, called Anna Komnene. And she, after her father, she was absolutely devoted to her father, but recognized that her father had made some dubious decisions throughout his reign, one of which, the crowning one of which in many ways, was to invite the Westerners, the Celts, she calls them, but she means people from Western Europe, the first Crusaders, to come to Constantinople and try and help him beat back the Turks who are heading from the east into Asia Minor, modern Turkey. So Anna Komnene, who was a brilliant historian and a great writer, composed a book called The Alexiad. And in the Alexiad, which is full of sort of ridiculous biases and sort of score settling and total sort of whitewashing of her father's reign, but is brilliantly written, you get the personalities pulsing through this book of who Anna Komnene was, and her view, a sort of Greek view on the Crusaders, which we so often overlook. You know, the view of the Greeks who sat between the Muslims of the Middle East, Near East, and the Christians of the West is absolutely critical. They're the sort of the pivot point. They're at the center of the story in many ways. So I use Anna Komnene's story as a way to get us into an unfamiliar kind of Greek view of the First Crusade, because it's very important historically we get that. And it's also wonderful to have this voice that's so lively that, you know, she could be alive today. You know, she could have her own sort of reality TV show today. She's got an opinion on everything. She's incredibly glamorous. She's sharp as a tack, you know. So this is a wonderful character who I just, love living with and love writing through the eyes of so much. So I was almost like very, very sad when she finally dies in the middle of the 12th century and you don't have her voice to guide you through this history anymore.
In chapter 4, you spent a lot of time talking about this Pope Urban II as the main kind of force of the First Crusade and its great success in recruiting people to fight for the cause of Christendom. What was so appealing about Urban's sermons that were so persuasive and intoxicating to the people who heard him?
I think it's the spiritual calculus. I think it's the offer. I mean, this is transactional. He says, come on, we've got to go and help the Byzantine Emperor. We've got to help Alexius Komnenos to win back his territory in Asia Minor. And we've got to go and liberate Jerusalem. I mean, that's promising anyway. But Urban offers a deal. He says everybody who takes the vow to go crusading, who sews a cloth cross onto their clothes, will be granted remission of sins. And in a world that is even more religious than our world today, this stuff really matters. He's saying, you know, you do this and your sins will be wiped away. I mean, literally, you will have a faster, if not immediate, passage into heaven after your death, and you'll be spared, you know, centuries of torment in hell or in purgatory if you do this. And so this is an incredibly appealing offer that he makes, and it I think it's more appealing than he is even dares to dream, because as soon as he's made this sermon and gone on a short preaching tour, 1095 into 6, we see all over Western Europe, you know, not just armies being raised, but ordinary people leaving their homes and going on this crazy march of 1,000 miles, which they're ill-equipped for on almost every level, with this almost apocalyptic end of days mission to go and save Jerusalem. I don't think Urban had banked on this. I really don't.
The biggest misconception people have when thinking about the Crusades is that it was centered entirely around Jerusalem, but that wasn't the case, was it? It was stretched across many parts of Asia and Europe and North Africa. What made the Crusades such a global phenomenon?
You're absolutely right. I mean, so the Crusades spill out almost immediately once they've hit Jerusalem. I think partly because the promise of what it means to be a Crusader we've just been talking about, is so attractive. And remember, the word crusade is a relatively modern term. So no one at the time of the First Crusade said, oh, I'm off on crusade, or the second or the third, I'm off on crusade. But they did know what a crusader was. Crucis Ignati, it's a contemporary term. It meant you'd taken your crusader vows. Now, as it turned out, almost at the same time as the First Crusade, popes were saying, look, you can take your crusader vows, and you don't have to go to Jerusalem. You can just fight Christ's enemies where you find them. So first, this is Spain and Portugal, because, of course, the southern half of the Iberian Peninsula was largely Muslim-held, Al-Andalus. But it quickly expands in the 1140s to mean the Baltic as well, you know, what's modern Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. And then after that, you know, the end of the 13th century, and it's, you know, it's going fighting against the Mongols in Eastern Europe, or it's, you know, it's going fighting against pagans in the Baltic states. It's going fighting against heretics in the Cathars, you know, in southern France. And then eventually it's just fighting whoever the Pope says is an enemy, Christian or Jewish or Muslim or just unbeliever or just, you know, or just someone the Pope has taken a dislike to. So at that point, by the early 13th century, crusading really detaches from its moorings, and it's only really about wherever you find crusaders, you find a crusade, and that, by the 13th century, can sort of be any way you like.
I was wondering if you could talk about this character you mentioned. I think it's Sigurd I of Norway. He was a Scandinavian king by 13, and then 17 set sail for the Mediterranean. What compelled him to take this journey?
Well, Sigurd's a fascinating character. You know, as you say, he's king by the age of 13, and at the age of 17, well, his father, called Magnus Barelegs, had left his kingdom to 3 sons, which was really, you know, too many. So by the age of 17, I think Sigurd was filled with, the natural Viking vandalist and, you know, desire to get out and go and do some plundering elsewhere, and B, just a sense that there were too many kings in the kingdom. And so he goes on this incredible adventure, which takes him from Norway to England, to France, to Spain, to Portugal. He plunders Lisbon on the, you know, the way down the Atlantic coast of what's now Portugal, to Ibiza and Formentera and Menorca, to Sicily, and finally to the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem, where he visits the Holy Sepulchre, where he helps the great siege at Sidon, which is in modern Lebanon. Then he goes off to Constantinople afterwards. And so he does a sort of world tour of the Crusader world. And it is actually a fascinating character for me as a narrative historian to use, because if you'll forgive the analogy, sort of sitting the camera on the shoulder of this character, you get a vision of the entire Crusader world. You get a free ride around it through his eyes. And that is such a more effective way of telling this story than simple sort of dry, dusty prose, which takes it territory by territory without any sort of interlinking, without any connective tissue. I've switched analogies already. So Sigurd is one of my favorite characters in the whole of this book, Crusaders. I think because, A, he's just so unlikely a crusader. I mean, this Viking going on crusade. But he's also just such a fantastically helpful character within the story to show this world rather than, you know, me having to sit down and laboriously tell about it.
Right. All right. I have one last question for you, Dan. There are still fanatics and terrorists who do killing in the name of God these days. And the last line in your book you have is that as long as there are crusaders, real or imaginary, in the world, the war goes on and on. From your research in running crusaders, were there any kind of lessons you thought that could be applied to the world of today?
Yes, there are. And I think that fanatics and terrorists, and, you know, whether they're Islamist terrorists or white supremacists, you know, alt-right, would have us believe is that this is an eternal zero-sum game, that one side has to triumph and the other side has to lose. And the repeating truth throughout history of this era is that peace has been made when a spirit of compromise between all sides has been reached. If you take Frederick Hohenstaufen, the great Holy Roman Emperor, and Al-Kamil, nephew of Saladin, Sultan of Egypt, they made a power-sharing deal, effectively, in the 13th century in Jerusalem, the sort of thing that today would earn you a Nobel Peace Prize. Their reward? Well, Frederick Hohenstaufen was excommunicated by the Pope 4 times and had a crusade preached against him. It tells you a little bit about how peace gets made, which is through sensible friendship and diplomacy, but also, I'm afraid, a little bit about the savage nature of the world, which is that no good deed goes unpunished.
Yes. You just listened to my interview with Dan Jones talking about his new work, Crusaders, the Epic History of the War for the Holy Lands. Dan, thank you for being here with us.
That's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And now this.
Hope you enjoyed that interview from the archives. We're your Right on Radio pals. We're all here in studio today. This is Annie.
And this is Dave.
And this is Liz.
And this is Josh.
Thanks for joining us this evening. We want to tell you that next couple weeks, some of us are going to be out.
It's a little summer vacation for some of us, eye surgery for some of us, and we're going to be bringing back some of our favorite episodes from the past few months.
Yep.
So if you've been on vacation at all this summer and might have missed something you're interested in, it'll be coming back around one more time.
Right, Josh?
That's right. I was just going through my mind right now. So we have programming that's going to be, so we'll be out of office next Tuesday. None of us will be here, but I think that maybe next 2 weeks we'll be out playing some fun, interesting interviews that we have deep in our archives that we have not played in a long time.
and we're really excited about this.
And speaking of archives, remind everyone that we do have a podcast.
Yes.
You should look that up wherever you get your podcasts and scroll around there. And I don't know how deep we go back, Annie.
We have a lot.
Past this calendar year, a couple.
Yeah, I mean, I've been uploading to the podcast for over a year. So if
that's great.
Anything cool. You want to re-listen to, anything you missed, there are a couple pod exclusives on there from when we were super, super busy.
And a special note as well, there is, I think, some special episodes where we have maybe little longer cuts. Maybe some...
extended play, we call them, I think.
Extended plays, and also maybe certain language you probably couldn't do on the radio. I've included on those cuts as well. Right, so you want to hear some obscene language, that's a place to go check it out.
Yeah, really, really. No beeps.
No beeps
no
there.
No beams.
Thanks so much, everyone, for being and checking us out.
We are so glad to be here. This has been Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie. I'd like to thank our special guest tonight, Chantel Pratt, her intrepid interviewer, Josh, and all of our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/rightonradio or looking us up on your favorite podcast app. Please stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota, and have a good night.